It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to the president of the Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce, who says Wisconsin can grow its economy by focusing on startup businesses.
First, late Friday, a federal judge ruled against Republican-backed election measures in Wisconsin, including part of the state's voter ID law.
The ruling came on the same day a federal appeals court struck down voting laws in North Carolina and a week after a different appeals court ruled against a voter ID law in Texas. And in Milwaukee last week, a federal judge determined voters could cast ballots without showing ID in November if they submit affidavits at the polls saying they couldn't easily get state-issued ID cards.
Patrick Marley is covering this story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he's a state capitol reporter. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Patrick, this was a sprawling 119-page decision. So can we start by having you walk us through some of the key areas of Wisconsin's voter ID laws that were struck down by Judge Peterson last Friday?
Sure. Part of the reason the decision is so long is because the lawsuit dealt with many different laws that have been passed in the last 5 years. Republicans have controlled state government during that time, and they've passed a number of laws affecting voter registration, probably the best known is the voter ID law, but they also put limits twice on when people can vote early. They eliminated straight ticket voting. They got rid of what's called special registration deputies. So the groups One Wisconsin Institute and Wisconsin Citizen Action filed suit over all of those laws, saying that taken together, they were designed to discriminate against either Democratic voters or minorities, people who tend to vote for Democrats. And Judge Peterson ruled many of those laws were unconstitutional.
Now, if upheld, which of these changes do you think is likely to have the biggest impact on Wisconsin elections?
Well, I mean, the voter ID sort of grabs all the headlines, but we're really, the changes to that law are kind of on the margins at this point. The state Supreme Court and the state and the federal court of appeals has upheld Wisconsin's voter ID law. So that is in place. It's a requirement that most people have with these two, the decisions that have come out in the last 10 days. They affect people who have the most difficulty getting IDs, sort of creating what the judges call a safety valve or a safety net for those people to vote. But you shouldn't underestimate the effects that some of the other things in Judge Peterson's ruling have on the way elections are run. The changes, for instance, on early voting, I think, are very significant. If that decision holds, there would be a much longer period of time for people to vote, and those decisions would be made at the local level. So places like Milwaukee, for instance, right now you can only vote. If you vote early, you have to do it at City Hall. They could have multiple sites where you can vote early. They could have weekend voting again. They could have evening hours, so times when they felt it was easier for voters to get to the polls.
Now, the language used was very pointed in this decision. The judge used the phrase, for instance, phantom election fraud at one point in a remark about the way that he perceived that these election laws unfairly target minorities in Wisconsin, and in particular African Americans who have been reliably Democratic voters. Can you tell us more about what he said about how he came to that particular conclusion?
Well, there's been a lot of research into voting fraud, and the type of voter fraud that voter ID is intended to crack down on is impersonation fraud. So somebody going to the polls claiming to be someone that they're not and voting in that person's name. That really doesn't happen, and Judge Peterson looked at the record and said that. And he also, one thing that the supporters of voter ID will say is that, well, there might not be this type of voter ID, but people are concerned that that type of voter fraud could exist, and so this gives people more confidence that their vote is going to be secure, that it's that no one's going to cheat the system, and that they can rely on the results. And Peterson sort of found the opposite, that the voter ID laws, and more than that, the debate that surrounds that creates a lack of confidence, and that all the claims or fears about fraudulent voting causes people to believe that there's more fraudulent voting than there actually is. But he also took pains to note that he doesn't get to decide whether we should or shouldn't have voter ID, that the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld voter ID laws, and the Seventh Circuit has specifically upheld Wisconsin's, and so he can't second-guess those higher courts.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a federal judge issued decision on Friday that struck down several Republican-backed election measures in Wisconsin. And Patrick, what kind of response have you seen from supporters of Wisconsin's voting law, including Attorney General Brad Schimmel and Governor Scott Walker?
So the Attorney General has said he's going to appeal this decision. This is definitely not the last we've heard on this. Expect to, you know, a lot more filings and appeals, and, you know, the rules could change at any moment back to what they were or some other set of rules. I'd say the response largely has fallen along party lines, which is really what we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years during these debates over voter ID and associated voting laws, which is that, you know, Republicans see them as very important and as a way to fight against any kind of fraud, and Democrats see them as an attempt to make it hard for people of color to vote.
And are Republicans also seeing this as an example of what they might call judicial overreach, or maybe a battle line between states and the federal government?
Absolutely, they've said that. They attacked the judge, James Peterson, as an activist and a liberal for this ruling. You know, it's worth noting he's been on the bench since 2014. He was appointed by President Barack Obama, so he hasn't had a long record as a judge. It's worth noting that he voted against Shirley Abrahamson, the former Chief Justice of Wisconsin and a liberal, when she sued to get her job back as Chief Justice. He was the judge that heard that case. He ruled in favor of the conservatives in that case. When he was appointed to the bench, Ron Johnson, a Republican U.S. Senator, praised his appointment there, fully supported him. But now we've got the Speaker of the Assembly here and the Majority Leader attacking Judge Peterson as a liberal and an activist.
Now, the Wisconsin case from this decision on Friday, it unfolded almost in parallel with a North Carolina case about early voting. How do the two relate?
So the North Carolina case is further along. There was a similar lawsuit there that challenged not just their voter ID law or their early voting hours, but sort of all of their suite of laws taken together. And that case got before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled that those laws were discriminatory and sort of right in line with what Peterson did. It's just that their decision has more sway because they're in appeals court. Now, that ruling is not precedential in Wisconsin because they're in a different circuit, but it kind of helps you see how the appeals courts are thinking and tees up this issue as something that could get to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, clearly, this Wisconsin case is going to be decided by our Seventh Circuit. We don't know what they're going to decide, but I think things are lining up for eventually the Supreme Court to weigh in on issues like these.
And Patrick, any idea when that might happen? Would it happen feasibly before the November election?
Well, I think that the Seventh Circuit is going to have to decide these things before the election. Certainly, they're going to, either they're going to say, because if they were to say that they were going to wait for a final ruling until after the election, in the meantime, they would have to decide whether what Peterson says goes for the time being, or to stay his decision and put the laws that have just been paused back into effect while they decide the matter. So one way or the other, they're going to be the arbiter of that. If they reach a final decision, either side can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Hard to say what happens there. The U.S. Supreme Court is short one justice. Courts are always hesitant to change voting rules when we get close to an election. So it sort of depends how close to the November 8th election we are at that point, I think.
And, of course, the August 9th primary just around the corner. Do you have a best guess about where we might be at that point?
Yeah, so that's next week, and I think it's important to note that none of these laws will be changed for that election. What's both Peterson in his decision and Edelman, who issued another voter ID decision, the one from last week, both of their decisions take effect after the August primary. So for this election, this primary that we're in right now, the early voting limits are what the Republican lawmakers set them out as. There's a full voter ID law in place. People have to show ID at the polls. If they don't show them on August 9th, they will not be able to vote. So on August 10th, that's when all the rules change for November, and we don't have these voter ID laws that are, or the full voter ID law and the early voting limits that we've had in the past. So is it going to be easy for voters to get confused? Absolutely, because you've got that little quirk there and also the possibility of further court orders in the next 4 months that would, you know, put these laws on and off. It could definitely make for a situation where your average person doesn't know what the rules are.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he was with us to talk about the ruling from a federal judge issued Friday that struck down several Republican-backed election measures in Wisconsin. And you can find a link to his piece about this story on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews with candidates running in the Wisconsin congressional primaries this month. We'll talk to a Democratic candidate in Speaker Paul Ryan's district.
Now, growing business in Wisconsin is all about embracing entrepreneurs and startups. That's according to our next guest, who says policymakers at the state and local level should be paying more attention to new business creation.
Zach Brandon joins us now. He's the president of the Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce. Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're trying to apply some lessons I think you've learned and taken in the Madison area for the state as a whole. Can you talk about when you came into the Chamber of Commerce in Madison about 4 years ago, what your priorities were?
So I used the word intrepid to define what I thought the vision should be. And so if you think about the word intrepid, it's, you know, it can be mean a lot of things, but adventurous, resourceful, hardworking, tenacious. But if you break the word apart, and the IN for innovation, the TREP for entrepreneurial, and the ID for identifiable. And so the goal was not just to make the chamber, but all of Greater Madison innovative, entrepreneurial, and identifiable.
Now, you focused a lot on startups and entrepreneurs, new business. And it seems like there's an ongoing debate, in a way, between economic policy based on, hey, we've got big companies here. Let's work to keep them around, help them expand, or to lure in other big employers, maybe from other states or regions. You're saying that's not the right road. What do you think? Why do you think startups, entrepreneurs, should be the main focus?
You know, to the middle part of the question about sort of the luring of companies or the border raiding. You know, you might get a couple one off, but that's a race to the bottom. That you states competing at that caliber at that level generally don't end up with a positive net increase to the jobs or to the economic output. When you think about how economies are created, and that's really where this was focused, is economies are created by the creation of community wealth. So community wealth is really disposable income, but you import other people's talent and wealth and ideas, you create a product, a service, some kind of good, then you export that. The income from that exportation, you try to recirculate amongst your economy as many times as possible. And so it becomes kind of goes from importing to the local economy. And so when you think about how economies are created, so I would give a little nuance. It's not just about entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. but really about entrepreneurship. So even existing companies, so if you think of the marquee companies of this state, so think Harley Davidson, Briggs & Stratton, SC Johnson, Johnson Controls, Kohler, Oshkosh Corporation, those are all named after either the founders or the city of their founding, which is about the truest example of entrepreneurship you're going to find. And so all, even of our enterprise companies, we're all entrepreneurs at one point in time. It's really about not just new company creation, but also transferring entrepreneurship into the big companies as well, getting them to think about themselves as disruptors, as change agents.
Talk about how a local community can get behind that entrepreneurial spirit. What can, at the government level, at the local business community level, the Chamber of Commerce level, what can people actually do to make an environment for this kind of business?
Sure. So in Steve Case's new book, Steve Case was the founder of America Online. He just wrote a book called The Third Wave, which is it's a roadmap as to where he foresees the economy going. And the third wave is the third wave of the internet. So the first wave, he argues, is just getting online. So it was, you know, CompuServe and AOL. It were the CDs for those of us who still remember getting inundated with CDs in the mail where we could sign up for 300 free hours. That was phase one or wave one. Wave two is where we are today. So it's building upon the internet. So it's Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, everything that uses the foundation of the internet and creates a lot of apps around. And there's been some good and lots of community wealth created by it. The third wave, he argues, is actually the transferring all of the data and the technology to existing industries. So it's health and insurance and manufacturing and agriculture, specifically food, energy, all those are going to be enhanced or disrupted by the internet. And the regions that are most likely to feel that change and that benefit if they're able to ride the third wave are the places where those businesses are located. And that's places like Wisconsin. That the industries, whether it's health or food, insurance, manufacturing, we are a hotbed of that. And his argument is that not the Silicon Valley will go away, but Detroit was Silicon Valley 60 years ago. That if you were an engineer or you were, if you were in the STEM industries, you gravitated to Detroit because that was the center of the, I guess, for the engineering economy. His argument now is it will shift back to the Midwest. And so the point of what the local economy can do is he has three P's. Policy, perseverance, and partnerships. And I think so one is what can be done at the state level and at local levels when it comes to policy that enhances the risk-taking that is inherent in entrepreneurship. Help develop partnerships, so getting out of these sort of regional silos. It's not Madison versus Milwaukee or Milwaukee versus the North. It's that we're in this together, that we have one economy in the state, and we should be doing what we can to help each other succeed. And then perseverance, and it certainly is a state of perseverance, as is the Midwest. And so we've already knocked down one P, I think. We've just got the other two to focus on.
We're talking to Zach Brandon, president of the Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce. Looking at the economic future of Wisconsin, he says promoting an entrepreneurial spirit, working with startups or innovation at existing companies are the key to the economic future of the state. And Zach, not even the economic future. You point out in the papers lately, this is part of our economic present. We have a lot of this already. There's a hub growing between Madison and Milwaukee. You want to build on what we've got. Talk about where we are now, though.
Right. Well, to that point, too, there's a scary undercurrent. There's an undertow to the third wave, too, that if you know that this is the future or you expect that this is the future and you do nothing, that not only will you not hold steady, not only will you sort of stay at baseline, but you are likely to go backwards as a state. And I think that's one of the scariest propositions. The state of our economy now, there's something interesting going on that last year the Department of Labor put out a map, and actually put out on social media. And on that map there, it said highest concentration of software publishing jobs in the United States. And there were all these bubbles around the country. And right in the upper Midwest, there was this huge bubble. And I thought to myself, I saw it on Twitter, and I thought, I wonder what that bubble is. Is that Chicago? Is that Milwaukee? What is that? Turns out it's Madison, Wisconsin. Madison, Wisconsin has the second highest concentration of software publishing jobs in the country. And so that defies a little bit of sort of what we think is reality. We think that's Silicon Valley. We think it's Austin, Texas. Turns out Seattle's number one. Madison's number two. And when you look at what Madison coupled with the rest of the state when it comes to software publishing jobs, 3.8% of all jobs in the U.S. in that sector happen to occur in the state of Wisconsin. On a pro rata share, that means that software publishing has the same penetration into that sector as manufacturing, as agriculture, as logistics, as printing. So the things that we think are baseline industries, we're actually doing so well in software publishing, but we don't even believe our own self-concept.
Is that, do we need to change our state brand in our own minds in a way? We think of ourselves as we grow stuff, we have cows, we have milk, we have cheese, and we have Harleys and things like that. Is this, do we need a mindset change here?
I think it's a little bit of a mindset change, but it's also the ability to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? We can say and we can honor and be proud of the historic industries, the legacy industries that have driven our economy. And if you believe in the third wave, will continue to drive our economy. But we also have to be thinking about what's the cusp of the next wave of the economy and where are we going next. And so it's a little bit, it is a mindset shift. It's a little bit of the ability to look at ourselves and see ourselves as something different than what we've been in the past. But we shouldn't lose sight of those other legacy industries because those provide a great opportunity for us to be the disruptor, to be the enhancer of those industries. Think about healthcare alone. Healthcare has the most inefficiencies and the largest piece of GDP, so it's the most ripe for disruption. We've got great companies. In fact, between Lake Michigan to Madison, there are almost 100 companies that in some way touch healthcare, whether it's delivery, whether it's payers, whether it's technology. We need to figure out a way to brand that. And so, we've been sort of cheekily calling it the health highway. But if that highway corridor between Milwaukee, Waukesha, and Madison were anywhere else in the country, or if it were in California, it'd be on the front page of magazines. They would be calling it a miracle. And here we can't get past Jefferson County.
You've got a major research university in Madison, decent research, a good research program at UW-Milwaukee. You've got Marquette over there, the corridor between. How do you expand that to other parts of the state, not just Madison, Milwaukee, and that strip of I-94?
Well, really, when you start to, you know, you pick up Marshfield Clinic, you pick up Gunderson Lutheran, which if you really took the corridor all the way out, you could pick up, you know, almost the entire state. And if you really thought big, you could go down to Chicago where they have pharma, and you could go to the Twin Cities where they have medical device. You could create a corridor, a much larger corridor, but you could create a corridor in the upper Midwest that would rival anything in the world. It's just a matter of being able to think big, to understand our, you know, this new self-concept, and then be willing to talk about it. In fact, brag about it, which is something we don't do well. The humble brag is not something that we're good at.
You've talked to other local business leaders around the state. You've talked, I think, to the governor about this. Are they ready to talk about this? Are they ready to have this conversation?
They are. I think, you know, the conversation with the governor was, it started off with this phrase. I said, Governor, in the next hour, I'm going to use the words Madison, Greater Madison, and Dane County a whole bunch. And every time I say that, I want you to think Wisconsin. So when I say Madison jobs, you think Wisconsin jobs. When I say Dane County's economy, you think Wisconsin's economy. Because that's how we actually have to be able to picture. It cannot be Madison versus Milwaukee or Milwaukee versus Waukesha. In order for us to succeed, one, we have to know where the puck is going, how it got there, and not think about whose puck it is. How's that for a sports metaphor in the middle of business talk?
We talk about divisiveness in Wisconsin politics. I don't know if you want to get into the politics that much. That's not a way people are really thinking these days. It's region versus region, party versus party. Briefly, as we wrap up, can we get past that?
Absolutely. Look at a place like Austin, Texas. Austin is beloved by Texas, which is, you know, very much a red state. In fact, some people joke it's a blueberry in the bowl of tomato soup. Austin's done a great job of proving that a progressive college town with a state capital can be an economic engine. And I think there's no reason why Madison, Milwaukee, and the rest of the state shouldn't be viewing the Dane County economy the same way.
Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Zach Brandon, president of the Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce. He's joined us to talk about how focusing on startups and an entrepreneurial spirit could help grow the state's economy.
Coming up after the news, we meet a Democratic candidate for Congress running in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear how important Wisconsin will be, maybe, for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the coming months.
First, we're taking a look at Wisconsin's first congressional district, where Speaker of the House Paul Ryan is the incumbent candidate.
We've been doing a series of candidate interviews ahead of Wisconsin's primary elections on August 9th, and we've invited candidates in contested congressional primaries to join us on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show.
Joining us now is Ryan Solon. He's one of the candidates for Congress running in the 1st District's Democratic primary. His opponent, Tom Brew, will be joining us tomorrow at this time. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
For starters, Ryan, why are you running for Congress?
I want to make a difference. I've been watching from the sidelines for a little while, and I felt that having done federal service in the past in the military, you know, I had the opportunity to serve my country, and this is another way for me to do it. I really want to push some ideas forward, and I think that this is the right time. You know, I think we'll really see some changes made.
You mentioned it briefly there. Can you talk some more about your background and how it would prepare you for Congress?
Certainly. I'm a transplant to the Wisconsin area, actually, back in 2000 when I moved here. I joined the military in 2004, so that did take me away for 8 years of active duty. I did do a tour in Iraq as well. Got out in 2012, and I made it to the rank of captain, had some leadership experience, had an opportunity to work with an awful lot of people from different backgrounds, and I think that really has prepared me the opportunity to work as a representative.
Now, you're running in the district of the Speaker of the House of the United States, Paul Ryan. If you face off with him in the runoff in the general election in November, what would you focus on?
I think at this point I'd be focusing on the issues of healthcare and education. I say healthcare primarily because if we were to push for a universal healthcare system, I think it would have the greatest effect on a number of different areas in government, and it would benefit the people the most, I think.
I'm looking a little far ahead there because you still have this primary next week. How do you distinguish yourself from your opponents in this district?
Well, I do count myself as a little bit more of a moderate Democrat or a centrist, if you will. You know, my opponent, Tom Brey, he does claim that he is the more progressive candidate, and I'll allow him to, you know, accept that label if that's what he wants to label himself as. But in this regard, I think that we're trying to find bipartisanship. We really want to make progress, and I don't know that we can do it if we continue gridlock the way it's been.
How would you, if you were elected to Congress, find bipartisanship? It's hard to come by. You might be in a House that would continue to be controlled by Republicans. How would you reach out and get things done?
Well, I have I've been asked the question before, what would I do? The first thing that I got into Congress if I was elected, bipartisanship all starts with relationships. You know, you may not necessarily agree with everything in somebody else's platform, but it's still important that you go to that person, you understand what they're all about, and you try and find that common ground. So if I was elected, I would make it my responsibility to try and meet with as many of the members of Congress as possible and find that common ground, find out where we could make progress on the issues.
We are continuing our series of candidate interviews this week with Ryan Solon. He's one of the candidates for Congress running in the 1st District Democratic primary, currently held by Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Let's get more into the issues, Ryan. You mentioned health care a moment ago. I know in your campaign material, you talk about the importance of a balanced budget. Obviously, a big federal deficit every year, a pretty big federal debt. Why do you think that's an important focus?
Well, we all know that the costs of health care are really high. And if we want to do some sort of a universal health care system, we're going to have the funds to be able to pay for that. So looking at the budget, to me, it's only the responsible thing to do. We need to get that budget balanced and start taking a look at the debt that we've incurred. Right now, we pay about $260 billion in interest every year, and that's just the interest alone that goes out the door. We don't get anything for that. To put a little context on it, in 2015, we spent $92 billion on education. So we could almost fund education three times over with just the interest that we're paying. So that seems to me the logical first step. That's what we need to do, is we need to figure out how we can start recovering some of that interest money back and roll it back into the system. In which case, then my plan, I would look at funding infrastructure. We know we have an awful lot of problems with it, and we need to start updating it. That alone would start providing jobs. And then, of course, as workers are getting these jobs, we're cycling money through the system. You're seeing greater tax base. And that's where you start to see the ability to invest in things such as healthcare and education.
That's some of the why to cut the deficit. How? What would be your priorities in terms of spending and revenue?
Well, there are places that we can cut. Obviously, there's some important things that, you know, we would want to try and keep funded. So I would think that every sector would have some area that you could cut the budget, and it would require some very detailed analysis. Every little bit would help. And, you know, I've always said this would be a very difficult task, and it's understandable. But, you know, we're Americans. We're used to tough things. We can handle this. It just might be a little bit difficult for a while.
And you've talked already about universal health care, infrastructure spending down the road. Those things would cost money. Would you be able to handle those priorities while still trying to get the deficit under grips?
I think so. Obviously, we can't do it just all at once. You know, it's not like taking off a Band-Aid after a little while. You've got to really constantly monitor this and take it gradually. You don't want to shock the system. We don't want our economy to tank because we decided to make a rash decision. We need to constantly watch it and make sure that we're making the right decisions for the right times.
You've also called for term limits, like those we have for the president in this country, for people in the Senate and Congress. What are you looking for, and why?
I think we need a little more turnover in our representation. We've got some people who have been in there for decades, and to me, that just doesn't really speak to a democracy. You know, I've heard the argument where people say that if they're really good at being a representative, then it's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think I would argue to the flip side of that is, you know, it really attracts abuses of power, or they get overly comfortable within that position, and we end up with more gridlock. in terms of the term limits, I find that, the way I've figured it out is two terms for a senator. That'll give them 12 years. And so I figure that if a senator can do 12 years, let's limit a congressman to 12 years as well.
So 6 2-year terms.
Correct.
What are some of your other priorities focused on your district now? What do you see as things facing Wisconsin's first district that you think the federal government, a congressperson, could really make a difference in?
Within the first district, I see a lot of manufacturing that has disappeared over the years. Jobs have become a very real issue there. People are worried. You know, if the economy is not there, people are going to leave the district, and we don't want that. We really want them to be attracted to the district. We want them to be able to find good-paying jobs and be able to live a comfortable life. I think the focus there then is we're going to have to find ways that businesses will be attracted to the area, whatever that may call for. The bottom line is we need to get people employed, and we need to make sure that they're able to live comfortably.
On the theme of jobs, there's been a lot of talk about trade agreements in the presidential race. Looking back as far as NAFTA and looking ahead at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, what do you think about the current state of affairs when it comes to trade agreements?
Well, I know we can't do without trade agreements. Here's the deal. We are a global marketplace. We have to compete within the world itself, closing ourselves off and isolating it just in the name of making sure that we keep our manufacturing 100% here would be a mistake. That would definitely hurt our economy. So what we need more transparent trade agreements. Now, my issue with the TPP is I don't think it's very transparent. I also don't think it's all about jobs. It seems to me that it's very geared towards the corporate sector for pushing a much larger profit. I think that we would really need to take a look deeper into it and look at the details to figure out just what it is being signed on to.
We're talking to Ryan Solon. He's a candidate for Congress in the 1st District Congressional Democratic primary here in Wisconsin, running against Tom Brye. That seat is currently held by Speaker of the House Paul Ryan.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Ryan Solon? What should Congress focus on next year, do you think? And if you live in the 1st Congressional District, what's the most important issue in your area? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking with Ryan Solon, candidate for Congress in the 1st District Democratic primary.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate if you're from the 1st District, currently represented by incumbent Paul Ryan? What issues are most important in your area? What do you think Congress, the federal government, could do to help you? What do you want to see on the top of the congressional agenda next year? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Call 800-642-1234. Ryan, before we go to our callers, of course, we've got this presidential race going on, kind of the big ticket item. Your thoughts on the primary in the Democratic Party between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and now this general election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Well, in terms of the Democratic side, we watched from the convention. The first day looked a little bit rough. I think there were some people who were a little bit worried with the way it was going. But over time, it did seem to calm down. And I do think that unity has really started to take a hold. I do find that Hillary Clinton is an excellent candidate. And I'm very glad that Bernie Sanders has endorsed her. And I think that that's going to go a long way as far as winning the general election. Looking at the presidential race in general, I know there's a lot of worry about Donald Trump. At this point, I personally don't feel that he is a strong candidate for the position. I really see this one going for the Democrats.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Scott is on the line in Milwaukee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I appreciate listening to an articulate individual that is making some valid, realistic points. My question is, how do you go against an insurmountable war chest that the current Speaker of the House is going to have behind him? And make no bones about it, that cash is going to flow from everywhere.
Well, thank you, Scott, for calling in. Yes, there is no doubt. I don't know that I would ever be able to compete with him on a financial level, but in my mind, that's not what this is about. This is going to be all about the issues. We have some definite need to move forward, and you know, money cannot necessarily purchase people when they've made up their mind. They want change. We've seen that. It's a really big push for it this campaign season, and that's where I'm going to focus. I am going to focus on his record. I'm going to focus on how he's made his decisions in the past and really try and push the idea that we need something different.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Taking a look at some of the other issues facing Congress, Ryan, immigration and immigration reform, elusive target for Congress for a long time. Again, big issue in the presidential race. What's your take?
I don't think that that a path to citizenship would be that insurmountable. I know it looks pretty bad right now, and it looks like it would be a difficult situation, but quite honestly, I think that we can make it work. One experience that comes to mind for me while I was in the military, it was actually when I was in Iraq. I was at one of Saddam's palaces where we were doing a military ceremony, and they brought out a whole bunch of soldiers who were not citizens, and they did their swearing in right then and there. So these were people who, you know, were not officially citizens, yet they served their country, and here they were. They were achieving that. You know, the path to citizenship is something we can definitely look at and put together. We just need to be logical about this and start talking it out rather than just constantly arguing.
We'll bring on another caller now. We've got Dave on the line in Caledonia. Dave, hi.
Good afternoon. What do you think of Congressman Ryan's reaction to his presidential candidate? I have my own opinion about, you know, the look on his face, what's been happening over the last 90 days. But what is your opinion about his reaction to the candidate of his party?
Dave, thanks for the call. So Congressman Ryan has publicly disagreed with Donald Trump on some statements and issues, but still supports him in the campaign.
That is very true. I guess I'll cut a very little tiny bit of slack for Congressman Ryan on this one. He's in a very tough spot because he's trying to be supportive of the party. And at the same time, he's fighting against a lot that's being said by Donald Trump. But that does not excuse him from, you know, from taking a stand. He needs to pick a spot and take that stance and tell people where he's at. Right now, it seems he's kind of going back and forth. He's on the fence, and he hasn't really decided. And it's going to hurt him. It's going to hurt the party. It's certainly not that great for Donald Trump.
Thanks a lot for the call. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Ryan Solon, candidate for Congress. He's in the Democratic primary next Tuesday. This is in the 1st District Democratic primary, southern part of the state here, the election next week, Tuesday. Again, you can join in with your questions on issues facing Congress at 800-642-1234. On your list of issues on your website, Ryan, you talk about your position. You've been researching it on gun rights and Second Amendment issues. Right now, where do you come down on that?
Something definitely needs to be done. It seems like the stonewalling is not going to make us any progress, and we already know it won't. Let's face it, we need universal background checks. We need to cover all the bases, make sure that no matter what the transaction is, that we're checking the person out who's purchasing the weapon. Second, we need to start looking more at education. You know, while being in the military, basic training, we went through 3 weeks of weapons training. It was all day, and I'm not saying that everybody needs to do all day training on a weapon, but the bottom line is they need to have more than what they're getting right now. They need to know the weapon inside and out. Now, my plan on this is taking a look at possibly licensing the individual the way we would license someone on a car. You know, you get a license for a car, and it's for a certain class of vehicle, so they know you're certified to drive that particular type of vehicle. You know, why can't we do something like that for guns? Why can't we certify an individual on a certain type of weapon, and that's what they can buy, that's what they can use? And this doesn't necessarily have to happen with the government. The government may be able to certify the trainers, and the trainers can maintain the records of who is certified. And in that regard, then we're not tracking who's buying, necessarily what weapons they've bought and owned. To me, it just seems like a more logical step.
Back to our callers now. We've got Linda on the line in Ferryville. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you? Good luck on your election campaign.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask what you would think about the idea of getting rid of the Beltway and bringing everybody back home, the senators, the representatives, because the Beltway is like crack to those people. Their kids get the best education, they get the best restaurants, they get wined and dined to lobbyists, and they forget about us here living paycheck to paycheck, wondering where the next job will be.
Linda, thanks for the call. I don't know how that would work at a legal level, trying to bring congressional representatives back home. But what do you think about that idea of more time, at least, back home in the district versus time in the Capitol?
Well, I certainly think the face-to-face time with the people they represent is a good thing. It helps them to understand what the people in the district are going through. We have the technology, obviously, to do video conferencing if that's something that people want to explore. I don't see any reason why we couldn't do things like that. Washington, D.C., though, it is the heart of the government. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. But, I guess there is a case to say maybe they need to spend a little more time in their districts and understand what their people are going through.
Linda, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Steve on the line in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. Brian, I'd ask, as even the Democrats must perceive the First District as being pretty much a foregone conclusion, what support are you getting, financial or otherwise, from the state or national offices, Democratic offices? Are they pretty much leaving you high and dry to run on your own in this area?
Steve, thanks for the call. Ryan, you're still in a primary campaign at this point, but do you see an interest from the state or national parties in supporting, if you're the candidate, your candidacy?
From the state, for sure, there's interest in what's going on there, but because there is a primary, they are remaining neutral, as well as the county parties, they're remaining neutral as well. The support we do get is more or less the moral support, telling us, we're doing great, they like us, we're doing all the right things. I imagine that after the primary, we'll see a whole lot more support coming from them.
Steve, thanks for the call. We've got Dan with us next in Maquonago. Dan, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. One quick question. I'm very much in support of the idea of term limits. How can we, we the people, encourage our current incumbents to advocate for such an action?
That's a very good question. I wish I had a perfect answer to that. They are comfortable where they are, and that would require that they vote against something that they're comfortable in. I think it becomes more or less a personal thing. In my mind, I see it as something that should happen, and therefore I would hold myself to following a term limit. Trying to convince them of that, well, that's going to be a little more difficult, I think.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Ryan, your primary is just a few days away. What message do you hope voters are hearing from you to get them to what's usually a low turnout kind of primary election?
The message I think that would be most important to people is to understand that their vote does count. And it's very important that they get out and exercise that right that they have. When we have a low turnout, then we're not really getting the voice of the people to elect the representatives that we should have. I really do want to push the idea of bipartisanship. I really want to see our country succeed and really make the progress that it should be making. If we don't get the voice of the people, then we won't see that.
Time for one more, a brief call. Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm just wondering what the candidate would do about climate change.
Tom, thanks. Ryan?
Well, for climate change, it's something we got to understand. We've been using fossil fuels and so forth for about 100 years, maybe more. You can't just cut it off and do something different because it wouldn't be feasible. We have to slowly take ourselves off of these. I think that solar and wind power are very feasible. They're getting better all the time. The technology is advancing. And as long as we continue to fund these technologies and push towards those, we'll see less use on the fossil fuels and the coal industry as well. And I'm not saying that we have to get rid of coal altogether because it is a stable resource as far as energy production goes. But we certainly need to reduce the coal use and try to go to things that are cleaner.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ryan Solon. He's a candidate for Congress in the 1st District Democratic primary. His Democratic opponent, Tom Brey, will join us tomorrow at this time. The Republican candidates in the race will be joining us on Wednesday and Thursday. The primary election will take place on Tuesday, August 9th. Here on the Ideas Network, we've been having the candidates in those contested primaries join us on The Joy Cardine Show and here on Central Time. And remember, when it's election season, you can always follow everything that's going on over at WisconsinVote.org, hosted by Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and our partners. You can find recorded copies of interviews with the candidates, voter information, where and how to vote, and lots of articles about the issues and candidates in the big races. Find all of that online at WisconsinVote.org. Thirty-five years ago today, MTV hit the airwaves, or rather the cable waves.
Today it's one of hundreds of cable channel alternatives, but it was a pretty big deal when it started, especially for us, Generation X.
Yeah, this was, you'll know when we're getting old when we say things like, I remember when MTV used to show videos. That's our cranky incarnation of Generation Xers. But I didn't have cable right when it came out.
I didn't have cable either. I had to watch MTV at my grandparents'. And I subjected them to, I remember, Janet Jackson videos. And I remember watching a lot of Aha, Take on Me. That was sort of the heyday of MTV.
I didn't really subject people to much. I think it was the grown-ups were over there talking, and I got to sit at the TV at my grandparents' house and watch the videos. But yeah, I remember they used to have on regular TV these half-hour or hour-long shows where they'd show the latest music videos. But yeah, MTV, it was nothing but videos. Now it's really hard to find a video on MTV, a music video.
I don't know if you do find them there. I think you mostly see it on YouTube and places like that. That's where I see videos.
Yeah, for a long time I'd flip through the channels and there's MTV and it would always be Jersey Shore. No matter what time of day, it was always, I don't know if they're anymore.
Were you a fan of The Real World, the reality series?
No. But Remote Control, the video game they had, that I liked.
Well, you're listening to Central Time.